Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, proudly presented by Butler Snow, where we cover topics of interest to lawyers handling appellate matters in Texas courts and beyond. This podcast demystifies appellate law and pulls back the curtain on the appellate system through conversations with judges, court staff, and top trial and appellate practitioners. Listen in to discover best practices and tips for successfully presenting your case, managing your docket, and promoting efficiency through legal technology. And now, here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders.
Welcome back to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. I'm Todd Smith.
And I'm Jody Sanders.
Our guest today is Justice Gisela Triana from the Third Court of Appeals here in Austin. Welcome to the show, Judge.
Thank you for having me.
We love it when we have sitting appellate judges on our show. We always learn so much about the inside view of the courts and an objective view of what judges think of appellate practitioners and things that they should or shouldn't do. So we're really looking forward to this conversation. Just to kind of launch us in, will you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself, your background, and where you went to school, and we'll launch from there.
Sure. So I grew up in San Antonio, went to Ursuline Academy, because if you're from San Antonio, you have to start with where you went to high school. That's just the way it is. But graduated from Clark and went to UTSA because my parents thought I was too young to leave the house. Graduated from there and then came to Austin for the University of Texas Law School, School of Law, and graduated, knew that I wanted to be a prosecutor. So I applied with the Bexar County DA and applied with the Travis County Attorney's Office here and got a job here. And so here I am. Gosh, that was in 85 that I came, or in 88 that I graduated. So 35 years later, still in Austin. So that's kind of how I started in the legal field.
So what were you doing at the Travis County Attorney's Office?
Well, I was doing what every person in intake does, which is you start off at the Justice of the Peace Courts prosecuting there. They figured you can't screw anything up too much. Reviewing, you know, probable cause affidavits, representing victims in protective orders, and then trying cases in the county court at law. So misdemeanors mainly was there. And then I decided to move over to the Secretary of State's office in the Elections Division and was a staff attorney over there for a couple of years. And always kind of had a political bug, kind of knew that I'd want to run for something, and decided early on that I couldn't stand the trading that I thought needed to take place if you went into the legislative branch. That I just wanted to be able to do what I thought was right without having to say, you know, trade horses and stuff like that. And decided, so after the Secretary of State, went out on my own and had my own firm. It was called Hanko and Triana. Went with Sharon Hanko, who used to be the supervisor in the Elections Division. And we thought, of course, that we were going to have a boutique election law firm, and really didn't think it out very well, in the sense that elections aren't coming around all the time. They come few and far between. And people like Buck Woods had pretty much cornered that market. So we started to just do whatever came in the door. Terry Weeks, who's a family practitioner here in Austin, has been for many, many years, would cases that he wasn't taking, would send them to us. So we started trying family cases. We were doing criminal cases, defense, criminal work, civil work, a little bit of election work as well. And decided fairly quickly that I tended to look at big picture kind of stuff. And so especially in family cases, sometimes, you know, and I've always told all young practitioners, you can fire your client. You don't like what they want you to do. You don't have to necessarily go fight for pots and pans in the courtroom. And that's kind of the way that I view the world. It's like, what's the best case scenario for everybody involved? And so decided that I wanted to try my hand at being a judge, and became a municipal court judge, where I thought I could do the least damage in case I got something wrong. And it's amazing because I remember the first jury trial I presided over, and you know, it's a traffic ticket. And I'm thinking, oh my gosh, what am I doing? Talk about imposter syndrome. You know, this cannot happen. And you're there, and then it just comes like second nature to you, right? You've tried cases. You know what you're supposed to do. You know how to rule. And then it kind of took off from there. I knew that I had found my calling and have been very blessed to have been able to do it for, I don't know, 28 years now, it seems like, I think.
That's really, it's not every day we have a guest who started off as a municipal court judge and wound up on the Court of Appeals. Mm-hmm. So, but you took a lot of steps in between. As I remember, you were, and this was before my time in Austin, but you were a county court at law judge on the criminal side, right?
Before that, I was a justice of the peace.
That's right. That's right.
And then I was a county court criminal judge. Well, I was a judge that heard criminal cases. That sounds really bad to say you're a criminal judge.
We all know what you meant.
That's a different episode.
That is a different episode. And I don't want to, don't invite me for that one, okay? And so I decided from there that I really wanted to do civil work and ran for, actually had to resign to run, you know, one of the judges who done that in Travis County because I was in the middle of a term. And so ran for the 200 district court and got there and was there for 14 years before I ran for the Court of Appeals. And Todd, if you would have asked me during the first 23 years of those, if I would ever want to go to the appellate bench, I would have said, no way.
Yep.
Why?
This is I've heard you say that. Yeah.
Where the action is.
I do want to explore that, but I don't, before we get into that, I'm curious about why you had to resign to run from the county court at law to the 200th, because I've seen sitting district judges not have to resign to run for a different bench. Why is it different between county court at law and district?
Well, there's this thing called the legislature that makes up laws. And so they in...
makes up.
Makes up. Makes, okay. They are the ones
people,
who...
People aren't seeing my air quotes.
Well, and you know, they at a very... Especially the representatives, not so much because they've got to run every 2 years anyway. But, you know, you've got senators that have 6-year terms. And what they saw was a lot of the county officials who would run against while they were still in whatever county election office they had. And so they passed a law that if you're a county elected official and you run for any other office and there's more than 1 year left on your term, it's an automatic resignation.
Oh,
so all of your county judges, your county commissioners, your county clerk, all of those, they run for something else, they automatically have to vacate their office. So when I announced my second, I had finished 2 years, I guess it was the end of my fourth year, but I was appointed to the county court at law bench and had 2 years on there and then ran for re-election, won that election. In the middle of my term, I decided to run. There was more than a year, so I had to give up my seat.
And as a county court at law, the appointment in that situation comes from the commissioners, doesn't it?
That is correct.
Okay. Because it's not a district court where it would be appointed by the governor.
Governor. Exactly.
Yeah.
So all of anything that's a county official vacancy will be appointed by the commissioner's court. District judges, court of appeal judges, they're all appointed by the governor.
Right. Well, and that's, of course, when I came to Austin, I think it was around the time that you took the 200th, and that's where I got to know you. And certainly you were very visible in and around Austin as a district judge and very supportive of a lot of the things that I was involved in, like the Austin Bar Association and things like that. How would you describe your experience as a district court trial judge? I mean, that's a lot of responsibility. Not that any of the other benches you've held weren't, but you're in the big time as a district court judge in Travis County.
And especially in Travis County. I mean, you're the first appellate court judge for all of the SOA cases, for all of the administrative cases. Mm-hmm. And being in Travis County, being the capital, the venue's here for a lot of that. So it is, I would say, one of the most powerful judgeships in Texas, being a district court judge in Travis County, at least for now. You know, that could always change. Stay tuned. But it was a little bit like drinking out of fire hydrant. I think that as a judge, we're very lucky in Travis County that we have a central docket. And so at the time, Judge Dietz was our local administrative judge, but Judge Muir was still around and she was kind of the dean of the mm-hmm. judges. And they were very protective of us when you started. So you weren't going to get your first high profile case. So the second week you got on the bench, they tried to be very kind about that. I had come up through the family bar before I became a judge. And so they kept me away from that, gave me other things that I needed to learn, administrative cases, which for anybody who's never done those, you know, all of a sudden you're like, I'm sorry, how does this work? You know, exactly. I don't understand this standard of proof. And so I got to learn from a lot of great judges. And pretty soon was hitting it full stride. People sometimes think that that's the best job in Travis County. I can't necessarily disagree with that.
For most clients, a supersedeas bond is something they may need once in a lifetime, and very few surety brokers specialize in supersedeas bonds. If your client needs to stay enforcement of a judgment in Texas or any other state or federal court, Court Surety Bond Agency is the company to call. Learn more by visiting courtsurety.com today.
It's a very busy job. I know that just from having observed many, many, many proceedings there, and especially once the pandemic ended. Now, you were on the appellate bench before the pandemic ended.
I knew what was going to happen. And I decided that being on an appellate bench was going to be a lot easier during the pandemic, which it was, than being on the trial bench. So I'm sorry that it all happened because of me, guys. Everybody suffered for those years.
No one else had the foresight.
Nobody had the foresight to figure out that it was a better job during the pandemic. So yes, they were crazy busy. You know, Travis County was one of the first counties that started doing trials on Zoom and didn't miss much of a beat. And so it was a different world for them. And now they have a beautiful courthouse. Yeah. I had to live with the rats running in my wall, you know, and screaming. But yes, so at least that paid off.
We've had Judge Crump on the show, and she's talked a lot in prior years before they went to the CFCF. The Civil Family Courts facility. And yeah, the stories about the rats were sort of legend. And the air conditioning that didn't work always.
It didn't work. If it rained too much, everything would leak. The wrong things would leak into the courtroom. It was definitely not the place that you'd want to bring people to show. Oh, this is our courthouse.
Yeah. Well, the new facility certainly is. Having been in. Yeah, it really is. Sometimes I go over there and I think, is this really our courthouse now? Is this, you know, where I get to go? And everything's so great. Well, the thing that I find confusing is just a slight aside. It's taken me a little while to get used to the elevator system. Where you don't punch a button in the elevator, you punch it before you get on the elevator. I've seen that other places, but.
Okay, yeah, I have not been in the Travis County Courthouse yet, but I know that system that you're talking about. You have to push your destination and then it tells you which one to go to.
That's right.
And you have to push it before you get into the elevator.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Invariably, if you're like me, who's thinking about 12 different things and is running late, you know, you're just in the elevator and you're like, now, and everybody's got in. And now what do I do? Just hope that somebody's in the elevator that's going to the floor you want to go to, or you have to go all the way back down. Button. So yes, that's a little, I'm sure it's very efficient. I'm sure they did it for a good reason, but it's a little strange.
Well, now I want to go back to, you mentioned, you know, if you never thought that you would be on the appellate bench. So after all this time sitting on the 200th district bench, what made you decide to go for it when you ran for election to the third court?
I had been a judge for 23 years. I had been on the county bench for 22. And it's like anything else, you want to grow. I had a friend who put it perfectly. They said, you know, people are like plants. You got to repot them. You need a bigger pot. You need some fertilizer. And I was at a point in my career where I loved my job, but really thought that going back to, it's very intellectually stimulating. It's like going back to law school and get to hear all these issues and you get to learn. And it's the idea of being on a little bit more of a bigger platform. And, you know, I don't want to say policy because we don't make policy. We are just enforcing the law that the legislature makes up, but it's something that became appealing to me. I was not an appellate lawyer. And I think you heard me say this, Todd, a couple of weeks ago when we had the breakfast, appellate lawyers and trial lawyers think very differently.
Mm-hmm.
We're just two different breed of animals. And I am a trial lawyer. I was a trial judge, and I think like a trial judge. And so we tend to want to come up with practical solutions. And one of the first things I learned when I came here is when people said, everybody wants to get it right. And I don't think that I have ever practiced or been a colleague with a judge who didn't want to get it right. And those judges are in the state of Texas, without a doubt, and everywhere else. But I've never been surrounded by anybody who was result oriented. Everybody really wants to get it right. When I came here, the difference was that what that means. And for appellate lawyers, usually that means not getting reversed. That's what getting it right means. For trial people, that's not what it means at all.
Mm-hmm.
So getting it right is, what is the right solution for this case here under the law? But what is the right outcome? And we all know that sometimes appellate courts disagree with us. So I was never concerned about my reversal rate. I was never reading the website sheets. Back then, they used to send us their opinions to the judges' paper opinions, you know, before we had, we'd get them through email. And so I'd get them and literally I would look at the last page or the first paragraph, reversed, affirmed. Okay. And if it was an important case and I needed to understand, then I'd read it. But I figured when you're a trial lawyer, they're going to tell you, the lawyers are in charge of telling you what the law is. And so I don't need to be so preoccupied with that. Appellate lawyers, that's what makes it right for them. If you get reversed, it's very much of some kind of black mark on you. And I'm like, I don't think so. That's not our job, right? That's a very different job than an appellate court judge. And the other thing, I've never run against an incumbent in all of the years that I've run for office. And not that there's anything wrong with people who do, but I wasn't built that way. And so Pemberton, Justice Pemberton, decided that he was not going to run. And so that was the first time that there had been a vacancy on the third bench that came, and that wasn't an appointment by the governor, that was the end of the term. And so I thought, okay, this is my time.
It is pretty rare to have an open seat on that court.
It is.
Has been. So yeah, that sounds like it was a great opportunity for you. I love your comments about basically how you identify as a trial judge. Yes, I did hear you say that at the Austin Bar Breakfast with the Third Court of Appeals. I think the State Bar helped to put that on too, State Bar Appellate Section, which is a great event. And I know, just as an aside, I think those similar events are happening through the State Bar Appellate Section and the local bars all over the state. And I think they're just wonderful to
attend. To encourage lawyers to go to those, because there's very few, unlike trial judges where you see people all the time, right? You're in front of them all the time. Mm-hmm. With appellate judges, it's seldom do we get to just interact on a normal basis where you can see each other and just talk and talk about normal stuff. And yes, talk a little bit about the law, but just other things. So I know the State Bar is doing those. If you're an appellate lawyer and you can go, I encourage you to go.
Right.
Well, I appreciate that you said as a trial judge, you wanted to get the practical solution, but then you didn't finish that sentence and say, because appellate lawyers don't look for the practical solution, which is true, by the way, but I thank you for not finishing that thought out.
Well, you know, I made a comment because Chief Justice Woody Jones was with us. He's now, Jody, our kind of visiting judge in residence. Mm-hmm. And so he's helped us out a lot. And, you know, he's an appellate practitioner, appellate judge. He is consummate. And I made a comment about that. It's good to have both, right? You don't want everybody to be a trial judge on your appellate bench. You don't want everybody shouldn't be. I'm not sure he agrees with me on that, but we do. There is. And you're right. It's like, no, it's clearly this. And you're like, no, not so clear that.
I think, was it you or was it Chief Justice Byrne that bestowed upon Chief Justice Jones the title of Dean of the Third Court of Appeals?
Was Chief Justice.
Not to take anything away from the Dean of Appellate Twitter, Rafi Mulconian, our friend. I chatted with Chief Justice Jones afterward and told him I thought that was a nickname that was going to stick, is the Dean of the Third Court of Appeals, because he certainly is deserving of that title. I want to tell a little story on you real quick, if I can. It's a positive story. It's not an embarrassing story. It's a positive story, and it's directly in line with your whole discussion of moving between the trial bench and the appellate bench and transitioning. I happened to be arguing before the court the very first day you were on the bench in the third court. And one of the things that struck me, and you were finding your way, and one of the things that struck me was when you went to ask a question in those first arguments, you would sort of preface it by saying, "Can I ask a question?" And
I do that anymore.
I don't think you do that anymore. And I was chatting with folks afterward, and I said, it won't take her very long to figure out that she doesn't have to do that. You ask the questions. You're the questioner.
But I'll tell you the difference, right? Because I used to always ask questions from the trial bench. You know, I was one of the judges. If it didn't make sense, not if it's a jury trial. If it was a jury trial, I would not say a word. But mm-hmm. if I'm the fact finder and I didn't understand what was happening, you know, that's a great thing. You can say, can you explain to me, what are you doing? You know, mm-hmm. but when you sit in a panel, and I think that's one of the biggest changes, you're used to as a trial judge, you make decisions. I don't have to ask anybody else for permission. Mm-hmm. I don't have to ask anybody else, what do you think about this? I don't have to read comments back on my opinions of, yeah, but what about this? And you didn't. So when you go from being a trial judge for so long and making all those decisions, and then you're now everything you do is with at least two people. Mm-hmm. So, and you're not the chief or the senior judge. So you're not the one who's running the meeting, in air quote, you ask, you know, I was like, can I ask, excuse me, I hate to bother you, but can I ask a question here? So yes, that took me a little bit, but it didn't take long for me to figure it. Now I just interrupt y'all and say, what I want to know.
As you should.
Tell us this. So I totally understand and appreciate and agree with our forefathers who thought that we should have a jury of 12 or 6 and that appellate courts should be 3 and the Supreme Court should be 9, because it makes invariably for better opinions, better reasoned opinions. And there's a lot to be said for having more than one view of the world in the room. And so I've come to appreciate it as when I was a trial judge and when I did read the opinions, my opinions that came back, and it's like, but that's, you didn't even deal with the most important issue that we sent you up. You just dealt with waiver, or you just dealt with this other issue and you didn't get to that issue. I'm sure, like it is for y'all, it can be very frustrating when you think you've teed up this great appellate issue that hasn't been dealt with before. And what you get back is, we don't even need to get to that, you know, and you're like, no, but mm-hmm. you do. And then of course you come up here and you're like, oh, now I understand. Why. There's three of you involved. And sometimes you don't agree on that issue, you know? Mm-hmm. And so if you can get an opinion that all three of you can agree on, hopefully, and if not three, at least two of you can agree on, that's what you're going to go with. And sometimes, I mean, we see it with the Supreme Court and their plurality opinions. It's like, okay, they can't get to 5.
Right. You know?
And so I've come to appreciate that it wasn't, we're necessarily trying to hide the ball. It's sometimes that's the best we can do. And so that's what we.
We don't see a ton of dissents coming out of the third court, though. You're smiling for those that can't see you like I can.
I have the most dissents. I'm like going, no, you don't. And it's nothing that I'm proud about necessarily. You know, it's nothing I'm ashamed about either. I think you're right. If you look, I think at Harris County, probably you get a lot more dissents than you do. Mm-hmm. You get more, definitely more en bancs than you do. Since I've been here in 4.5 years, almost 5 years, we've had one en banc, and we've had, well, that's not true. We've had two en bancs, and one, we actually had argument, which nobody can remember the last time we had 6 judges in oral argument. So that's kind of neat. But where I was going with that is that, and I don't know, maybe it comes from being a trial judge and thinking things differently. And so I'm not afraid of dissenting. I take it seriously. And if I, and not that anybody else doesn't, but we as a court, and I think in 2018, when the 4 Democrats got elected, and not only in Travis County, but Dallas, you know, there was 8 new judges on the 5th in Harris County. There was this fear that, oh my gosh, jurisprudence was going to go out the door. And that, you know, everybody was going to just kind of burn the house down. And I'm proud to say that in the third court, you didn't see any of that. The idea wasn't that the people before us were getting it wrong and right. we're here to correct that wrong. The idea was that they've done a good job doing what they need to do. And we might come from it in different ways, but we don't need to rewrite the book. And so I agree. I don't think that one, I don't think you see a lot of change in jurisprudence in the third court that people thought you would. And two, I think for the most part, we try to be agreeable.
Providing surety bonds for court-related matters is a very niche industry, and there are very few appeal bond specialists who are as experienced as Court Surety Bond Agency. Whether the client is a sophisticated entity or an individual involved in litigation for the first time, CSBA uses its more than 110 years of combined surety experience handling appeal bonds to provide first-class service to its clients. For more information, visit courtsurety.com. There was a turnover of 4 seats when you took the bench. So that was Justice Baker, Justice Smith, you, and Justice Kelly. You were the only one with judicial experience. I'm sure it was interesting coming in with colleagues with no previous judicial experience. That gave you a leg up, I would imagine, certainly at New Judges School.
Yes, I had gone to New Judges School at least twice already, you know, before, but it was different with the appellate track, obviously. You know, I think that there was a little bit of, okay, well, now I'm not the senior judge. So you'll know seniority basically was a lot drawing, and it came out in age appropriately enough. So our seniority, Justice Baker was, you know, the one with more seniority, and then I came, and then Justice Kelly, and then Justice Smith. I think that's the way that folded out. But I think there was a little bit of that. But let me tell you, I got disavowed really quickly of any idea that my trial experience was going to work in convincing necessarily others. I bet you, well, within the first year for sure, you know, I had an opinion that came as a trial judge that I got reversed by my colleagues here. here. I'm just like, hey, you got to do what you got to do. So, yes.
Hopefully it wasn't an abuse of discretion standard of review.
I don't remember.
that would have been an awkward opinion to write.
I know, right?
Especially if it came later and it was Chief Justice Byrne that was the author of the opinion.
Well, I think it was Justice Smith was the author.
Either and way.
Obviously, you're recused, so you don't get to read it until after it's done, you know, but sometimes it's funny things like that.
That is good. You look for practical solutions. That's the lens that you see the law through. But applying the law, obviously, is the way that you described it. So what kind of mindset shift, though, did you have to go through? You talked about how appellate judging is more isolating. You're kind of working in a bubble a little bit. You've got the other two people that you've got to please. Were there any other mindset shifts that you had to make to get used to the new job?
Well, the whole thing of things, not everybody sees it the way you do is great, but then at times it can be a little frustrating. So when I say practical solutions, obviously we're all constrained by what the law is. And like I said, all judges want to get it right and follow the law. But I'll give you an example. I want to understand. So we've had cases and they have to do, we have all the franchise tax cases. Everybody knows that you can either file a protest, file for reimbursement, file for an injunction. Those are the three things you can do. But we never see usually, well, that's not true. We do see injunctions, but not that often. But to me, there's got to be a system for where a person wants to contest your taxes, what you need to do. So do I need to pay them up front? If I can't pay them up front, do I need to, what do I need to do? And that's kind of like practical solutions. And I felt sometimes what we have is piecemeal. So we will have a case where the government says, well, you did it wrong. You didn't do it in these proper steps. Okay, I understand that. And then you say you have to do this. But then 5 years later will be another case. And it's like, well, this, you did that, but this you did not do correct. And I'm like, okay, by the third case, I'm like, can we just tell them how they're supposed to do it? Because it's like, you know, we keep on batting it down. And mm-hmm. To me, that is whack-a-mole. I don't think that's practical. I don't think it's right for us to allow the government to keep on making new inventive arguments on how you didn't do it exactly right. Well, what is it that they're supposed to do? The only way you can do it is reimbursement. If that's then, you know, shouldn't the legislature tell us that as about a protesting or so that's kind of I have to deal with because not all my colleagues feel that way. You know, they're mm-hmm. like, obviously, we cannot give advisory opinions. I get it. Sometimes we disagree on what advisory means. For example, one-line denials on mandamuses. Mm-hmm. I get it. I've had them. But if it's something that the relator can fix, why wouldn't we kind of give them a hint of what it is that, you know, if it's because you didn't give me a record, mm-hmm. why can't we say we're denying it because you're supposed to give us a record?
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to the one-line denial. A one-line denial could be substantive, could be procedural. I don't mm-hmm. know. You know, if it's a substantive issue, and there's a lot, yes, one-line denials are great for that, right? Because I'm not going to sit here and just tear you apart and write your mandamus for you. But if right. it's something that I think, I mean, you see that coming through the legislature, as you know, they passed a bill in which the Court of Appeals, if you're not going to take a discretionary appeal, you have to give the reason for it. Everybody's asking, what does that mean? I mean, are we supposed to write a whole opinion on it? Or do we just parrot what the law is, which is the reasons why you didn't? Oh, yeah, the reason is because either this is not going to further the litigation, or what exactly does that mean? And we don't know. We're going to see mm-hmm. once we start doing that. So I get it, which is, once again, that's my mind frame, which is, okay, I know that we're looking at this little thing, but it really would help us all along if we could give a little direction. So,
right. It's kind of the appellate equivalent of the trial judge not giving reasons for granting summary judgment.
Yep.
Exactly. Which, so they tell you, and I'm sure you've heard this before, but they tell you, baby school, the first thing they tell you is the trial lawyer, rule and run. Rule and run. That's it.
You I've heard it before. Yeah, that's
not
awesome.
Not sit there and explain your ruling, because as an appellate lawyer, if you just say granted on that motion for summary judgment, then I have to just figure out everything mm-hmm. that possibly be, which one, and do it all. If you are real specific about it, then that changes the whole ball of wax. So, you know, some of us, it's hard for us to, I was never good at that. Haven't been a trial lawyer, which is okay. I just want to understand. So I'd like to explain my rulings. But yes, there is that frustration with, and I tell trial lawyers all the time, no, don't give explanations. Don't, you know, unless you have to. If you have to give us findings of facts and conclusions of law, then yes, you have to do it. But short of that, no, nah, don't.
It, right. it would make for shorter briefs, though, on appeal if they did.
Yes, it would. Less issues sometimes. I mean, that's a tough thing. And that's the other thing that it's all over. Because depending on the judge, you've got judges. I mean, read the opinions. It's either, we always tell people, can we just do like your top three, four issues? You know, don't give a single issue. Yep. Because a couple of things happen. One, I tend to think that none of them are very good. And clearly, you have some really, really good ones. So, but I've seen opinions written. And I think the third court, we try to, I mean, we will address every single issue that you have. And sometimes you've got 60-page opinions, you know, and you're like, holy cow. But then I've seen other judges who will basically address the first three. And then everything after is like, well, this is sort of like what I said for the first one and second one. So we're denying it, you know, and so this is, so we're affirming. And it's like, okay, by that point, they ran out of steam, you know, the thing they were going to say, they've already said. And so we're going to do the thing you did, which is just tack on all this one paragraph. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that issue's not a good issue. You know, and you waive this issue and, you know, that's the rest of the opinion.
Oh, there's that dirty word, waiver.
Yes, it is a dirty word.
I'm glad to see, I don't see that as being the basis of all that many rulings on appeal. I know that the court, including the third court and certainly the Supreme Court, make every effort to get to the issue without finding waiver. But waiver, I just kind of argue the counterpoint there, what the law is, including the law of waiver. So it's a tricky one, I would say.
Well, and so when I came here, right, I was of the opinion, appellate courts just try anything to get out a case with the least amount of words possible and the quickest way possible. And so everybody starts off with, of course you do with jurisdiction, because you have to, jurisdiction and waiver. And then you get here and you realize how your hands are tied a lot of times. So I know this isn't my time for the tip, but my tip is, for the love of God, can you preserve your error? You know, preserve it. Because sometimes I cannot help you. I cannot not say it was waived and go to a very good issue you would have had if you would have just preserved it. And now that I'm preaching to the choir, because I'm assuming that most people that listen to this podcast are appellate lawyers, and who I need to be talking to are the trial lawyers, which is whether you have appellate counsel with you, or that's a tough thing. I get it, because
it's
tough when you're ruled against. I think most judges are fine allowing you to make a record, but when you have a jury and they're trying to, you know, you're trying to move it on and you don't want to be the cog in the wheel and you don't want to upset the judge who is still going to rule on 20 more of your objections, but you've got to. It's that, okay, you know, make your bill of review. Mm. Make sure that I have what I need in front of me to be able to help you. You know, help me help you. So that's my tip, which is just as much as you don't want to do it, as much as a trial lawyer, for the most part, unless they also do their own appeals, wants to just get to the end of it, don't take your time to make your appeal. Take your time to make your record. And if not, definitely use your motion for a new trial to take care of what you need to take care
right.
of.
Right.
Well, we agree trial with you. Lawyers, so thank you.
No, we totally do. Yeah, thank you. And it's also a good opportunity for us to say that's one of the reasons to have appellate counsel at trial mm-hmm. is to make us the bad guy in front Absolutely. Of the judge.
That's right.
We can totally be the bad cop. And I know you saw this a bunch when you were on the district bench, but the trial judges usually know who we are when we're in the courtroom. Mm-hmm. And so they know what our role is. And we don't mind if trial judges get a little irritated at us because we know how important it is to get that error preserved. Because mm-hmm. the last thing you want is to get down the road on an appeal when you were embedded at trial and not have made an objection that you knew you needed to make because you're trying to spare, you know, drawing some dirty looks from the trial judge or the jury having to come in and out
don't even get it, right? I mean, they're cross-examining or they're directing a witness and you're looking for that 1 second at what you're going to say next or whatever. And it comes in and you don't object and whoops, oh, sorry. Mm-hmm. You know, you've objected to it every single time before. But so I agree. And, you know, as a trial judge, I get it, especially if it's a jury trial because you're trying to move it along. But there's a very respectful way of doing it, and you can get it done even if it's after the fact. You don't have to necessarily, I mean, sometimes obviously you have to object, but if you're making your bill, you can just do it later. So I agree. Y'all, it's good. We could all sit around and be mad at y'all in the trial court.
Yeah. That's right. That's what our role is.
Damn, make everybody annoyed. Lawyers. Yes, y'all are so annoying.
We try.
I want to ask, has your view on jury charges changed between your time on the trial bench and the appellate bench? I think I see that practical side really coming out from the trial judge standpoint, but talk about an area where objecting or not is absolutely critical. How has your new role, it's not new anymore, you say 4.5 years, how has this role changed your view on jury charges and charge conferences, if at all?
Well, you know, as a trial judge, I was one of those judges that sometimes people hated because I'm like, if it's not in the PJC, it's not going in my charge. Mm-hmm. That's the one thing I can do to just kind of, and sometimes that wouldn't even work, right? But for the most part, 99.9% of the time, I was going to be golden. So it didn't change much. I mean, my view on it is, and I'll tell you where it is different, is in criminal cases. For the life of me, I don't understand why criminal courts can't get criminal charges correct. They've got different, you know, you have your application, you have your charging. I mean, so you have to know what you're doing, but we find error in criminal charges, I don't want to say all the time, but so much more than we do in mm-hmm. civil cases. Having said that, then I'm going to say, how many cases do you know of? How often does a charging error result in a reversal and remand for a new trial? I mean, y'all see it?
Sometimes.
Yeah, it does happen.
I'm not saying it doesn't happen, but to me, I think it's more uncommon. I think when we have charging errors, of course, you've got your standard and you have to show your showing harm, I think is a lot harder than most people think it is.
Yeah, I think that's true.
I would agree with that.
You know, because you're looking at everything else and you're like, oh yeah, no, the judge screwed up. And like I said, we find it. It's not uncommon for us to find there's charge error. But then when you do the test of, okay, but how much did it harm you? That's where people get in trouble. And so I don't see that, at least in our court, we're reversing a whole lot because of that.
That's one of the areas, I think, where showing error is one thing, but showing harm is another. And mm-hmm. that's where I think having somebody who's made this argument before can really come in handy. It's a fine point of appellate advocacy sometimes, writing that part of the brief where you're having to show harm. And it really requires sometimes a fair amount of mental horsepower mm-hmm. to get there. And, or maybe it's just me, I don't know. But we like to do our patting ourselves on the back as appellate lawyers. It's about as often as we can. And it's like you say, Judge, we have a pretty friendly audience for it.
Yeah.
But that is, I think, one of the hardest things to do sometimes is to get to that point where you feel like you've really made a good argument, unless it's just blatantly obvious. where you've made a good argument for showing harm in a jury charge error.
Mm-hmm. And those are going to get reversed. I mean, those are the ones that I see reversed, where you're dealing with something fundamentally wrong. But I mean, a lot of the arguments we get, well, the judge put this in and it comments on that it's an inappropriate comment on the evidence. And you're like sitting there going, that's hard to show, number one. And number two, where's your harm? So mm-hmm. I think that that's usually problematic. But I see it more on the criminal side than I do on the civil side.
Hmm. Well, one thing we do want to talk about that we've covered a little bit on kind of our recent episodes is the new Court of Appeals that's going in Austin, and just kind of what that looks like and how that's going to impact your court. Because I know a lot of the cases that are going to head to that come directly out of the third court.
So, yes, we did, when we went and testified in front of the legislature about it, against it, our own review of the last, I want to say 6 or 7 years of cases, administrative cases, I want to say are like 10% of our docket. Mm-hmm. So it'll impact us some, but work-wise, not at all, not much. One of the things that, and I'm sure as y'all know, nobody asked us or any other Court of Appeals what they thought of this. And one of the things, we start off with 3 judges and then we get 5 judges some point in the future and on the 15th Court of Appeals. But if our numbers are correct, they're probably going to have 130 cases on their docket. We dispose of over 800 cases on our docket. Each of us dispose of about 120 cases a year on our docket. So you've got 3 to 5 judges doing the work that right now. And that's with docket equalization. So it's not just the third court of appeals. That's kind of an average, you know, for all of the judges on the courts of appeals who are, I just don't think their docket's going to be very, very big. Now, they are going to have all those business court appeals. Mm-hmm. So I don't know, maybe that's going to make up. Maybe that's going to be a lot of those $10 million cases, that over $10 million cases that they're going to be spending their time on.
That's what I was going to ask you. In that number, you're including only the cases that, well, they're administrative, but there's also certain other categories of cases that will immediately be transferred into the 15th court when that case becomes active. And I noticed that the docketing statements, the court's docketing statements, for example, which you may not ever see, Judge, already have a question, because I know, you know, the courts have been told you have to start looking at these cases even now, because as soon as the 15th Court of Appeals becomes activated, those cases are going to be transferred over without regard to docket equalization, as I understand. So there will be some number of cases that that court will have right away, whether it's 130 or what. I don't think we have any real feel. As far as I know, there's not any good statistics on what will qualify under the new business courts to be transferred over at the either $5 million or $10 million level. Have you seen any numbers on that?
There is no data on that.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
No data on the business courts. And the only data there was on the 15th Court of Appeal came from our court, because we had people actually go case by case. They're administrative cases. But I mean, all of the, if you take out the business court appeals, they're going to get things where the attorney general is, whether it's administrative or not, but attorney general is on there. The state is being sued, or one of the agencies, or it's a constitutional issue about a state action. But that's really what's going there. So when I say administrative, I'm like, anytime you're suing, you know, the state, except for child support cases, those aren't going to go there. Criminal cases, those aren't going to go there. And there's some other things that won't go to the 15th Court of Appeals. So the way that they've structured this, so nobody knows what this is going to look like. I heard Judge Amy Clark Meacham, who's the local administrative judge here in Travis County, you know, she was stating that it's going to be a little bit like the TCPA. It's going to take 2 decades for us to even know what it means.
Here it comes, Jody.
Good news for appellate lawyers. Yes. Bad news for everybody else.
Yes, exactly. So as to the business cases, well, starting September 1st of 2023, this year, anything that has exclusive jurisdiction, those cases we were talking about in the 15th court, they're earmarked for the 15th court. Mm-hmm. And so we will not touch those unless, of course, there's an emergency stay, something that we need to take care of. But those will go to the 15th. If your case is in our pipeline before the 1st, you're stuck with us. So we don't, I kind of wish we could just say, here are all these.
Right.
You know, since we don't even know is what the third court and other courts, is it going to be have any precedential value? for the 15th court.
I look forward to having to deal with that issue, actually. As an advocate, it's going it's going to be so interesting to be arguing what is the law, especially when you've got a split, or you've got maybe not a hard split, but courts have not expressed uniform disagreement. What's it going to be? Are you making a prediction of what the Supreme Court of Texas is going to rule, how they're going to rule, or is it the majority? Or I don't know, but I know that this is a sensitive topic in many ways, because I know the third court is affected more than most other courts will be. But from just an advocate's perspective, I mean, Judge Meacham's not wrong about how it's going to have to shake down. It's going to be a long time. Shoot, mm-hmm. my career may be over before this thing is completely settled. I don't know.
It's going to be the Wild Wild West. And I think appellate lawyers, it's like, you can be creative. You can argue your heart's content because you've got a brand new baby court. And who knows what that's going to look like. Mm-hmm. So I think it should be very exciting for appellate practitioners. Mm-hmm. And it is sensitive. I think if there was any data behind it, I think that if, you know, anybody could have ever explained, short of the governor saying, well, those liberal judges in Austin, you know, we can't let them make decisions that are statewide important. Literally, that's what he said. You know, short of that, nothing really. I mean, we asked Senator Huff, and I didn't ask, Senator Johnson asked, is there a complaint about what's going on right now? You know, it's the third court. No, we're not. Nobody's complaining about anything. Nobody's doing anything wrong, but they're just overworked. And we just need statewide elected judges to do statewide work. And it hasn't come up before. I mean, it hasn't. This is not the first time it's come up. So there's been plenty of time to do research on it, like with the business courts, but nobody's interested in that. So we went from one legislative session, the session before, when, if you'll remember, they were trying to minimize us into 7 appellate courts. Right. They were going to redistrict us all, and they're going to put the 5th and the 3rd together. We had this district from Dallas to Travis County and
the I-35 district.
The I-35, yes, through Waco. You know, so we were all going to be kind of in one district. And we went from, we have too many courts of appeals and it's too confusing. And, you know, you've got 2 in Harris County and you've got some counties that overlap between districts. And this is just confusing. We need to minimize it to, we're going to do a new court. I'm confused about what the reasoning is other than it's political. And we've all made it. I've made it at least a lifetime of not being political and not letting my politics affect my job, to be told at somewhat the end of my career, I'm sorry, but you're too liberal. And so therefore, we're going to take cases away from you. Not because you're not qualified, not because you can't do the work. But, and remember, of all of those administrative cases, the ones, the high profile, are minuscule number, not even 1% of those cases that come up. We, in 2018, we had 2 Republicans and 4 Democrats, and it would not be uncommon for me and Chief Justice Rose to be on one side and have somebody else on the other side, irrespective of parties. And so we managed that very well. There wasn't a revolution. It wasn't the revolution everybody thought it was going to be. We took precedent like, okay, no, this is what the third court has said, and this is what we're going to do. So it's disingenuous, and it is hurtful. It's like our judges should not, we shouldn't politicize our courts. I know that they've done it in the federal courts. And so I guess politicians think, why can't we do it in state court? But for any lawyer worth their salt, who really paid attention in law school about, you know, what we're trying to do and what democracy is about, and 3 separate, forget about co-equal, we've never been co-equal, but 3 separate branches of government, it's really disheartening. And don't get me started on the business courts, where we're now going to have appointed judges decide these multi-million dollar cases, appointed by the governor, up for reappointment every 2 years.
Even that raises its own issues. I mean, you assume there will be reappointments, or else how many cases could that judge actually dispose of in 2 years?
But, and it's the big ones. It's the $10 million cases that we're going to dispose into. No.
Yeah, I know. I think that ties in also to what you were saying about the 15 courts workload. I mean, sure, they're going to have cases to work on day 1, but the business courts don't even become activated until the same day. And so there's not going to be any cases tried for quite some time in mm-hmm. the business court. So I think maybe that's the reason for the 3-judge, 5-judge phase in, but those 3 judges might be playing tiddlywinks for a while.
I think definitely they won't have anything from the business side. It's interesting because one of the reasons why they wanted business courts is it's the idea that businesses deserve to have consistency, right? And so you have these big cases that are all over the state with different judges, and some of them aren't up to speed necessarily, you know, and so we're wanting people who have this experience. And I'm like, okay, so the 15th Court of Appeals has to be experts in agency law, administrative law, and complex business litigation. And I'm like, you know, the only people I know who are experts in that sit on the Travis County bench or on the 3rd Court of Appeals, because those are not areas of law that people tend to become expert in. You know, I don't think most people who are litigating complex contractual cases necessarily know what's going on in the TCEQ, but I could be wrong. There could be many, many.
That's so far outside my area of expertise. I don't know. It's certainly not me who's an expert on that stuff.
Oh, me either. I get my mind around complex business disputes, but the administrative stuff has always been a little more challenging for me. Although, you know, I've had more than one appellate judge tell me, well, it's really just statutory interpretation. I don't know. I can't get my mind around the substantial evidence standard, and because it's just so different than what we do day in and day out ordinarily in litigation. So.
Absolutely. And not only that, sometimes it's, yes, it is statutory construction, but sometimes you're dealing with a different statute. You're dealing with different agencies. So it's not as easy to say, oh, sure, read the words. No, that should tell you what to do.
And how much deference goes into the agency interpretation? That's another big issue.
Absolutely. You know, which the legislature tried to get rid of this last time, but that bill didn't pass. They wanted zero. Some people in the legislature wanted zero deference to the agency's opinions. So, which will be interesting, because if that ever passes, because I'm like, wait, that's where you start. You know, yeah, right. Do you understand what substantial evidence means? Because I don't think you do.
Wow.
We're really grateful for all the time you've spent with us today. And this has been so insightful. But before we leave, it's always our tradition to end with a tip or a war story. I just wonder if you have any that you'd like to share.
Well, other than my preserve your record, preserve your error, it's been, well, I mean, you just have seen so many things. I'm going to leave from the beginning. You know, I think that older you get, you tend to remember what happened at the beginning and, of course, what happened at the end and not so much in between. So I was a municipal court judge, and not only did you get the exciting traffic jury trials, but you arraigned everybody who got arrested. So you got to arraign some interesting people. And for the most part, they would bring them into court and you would let them know what they're being charged with, what the bond set at, you know, and usually you're the one who would set the bond. And I had a, I'll never forget, this is obviously was very impressionable on me. There was a gentleman who they could not bring because he refused to put any clothes on. And so they said, Judge, would you come to the jail to arraign him? And I'm like, what exactly does that entail? And so they take me down and he's in a single cell, and it's those that basically the door you can't see through, but you know, you have a little opening for where you can give them papers or give them food or whatever. And it's kind of big. And so I said, you know, I came down and opened and I said, you know, Mr. Doe, I'm Gisela Triana, you know, I'm a magistrate here in the city of Austin, and I'm here to tell you, you've been charged with, and it was public intoxication or something like that. He wasn't a major criminal. And he stands up. Oh, I'm so-and-so. It's so nice to meet you. I'm like, no, sit down. Sit down. Don't need to see it all. I'm good. I'm good. And I had to go through my whole spiel.
Oh, no.
You know, and I was like, please, please. And he was just trying to be as polite as, because, you know, my company, you have a female, you're going to stand up. I'm like, no, no. You know, things like that, that you remember. Oh, my gosh, crazy stuff like that. So,
oh, gosh,
not sure how much of a war story that is.
That's quite a war story. I can see why that would have made an impression that stuck with you.
Oh, yes.
That's right up there. Well, thanks again for being with us, Judge. We really appreciate it.
Well, thank you for inviting me. I appreciate that y'all do this. And I always look forward to reading y'all's tweets and hearing from the folks that come in here. So thank you for inviting me.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, presented by Butler Snow. If you're enjoying the show, please recommend it to your colleagues or leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We appreciate everyone who has rated the show and otherwise supported us so far. To stay in touch, suggest topics, ask questions, or express interest in coming on the show, visit us online at texapplawpod.com or tweet us at texapplawpod. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.